Comics. Comics. Welcome to ORP, otherwise known as Omen Revelations Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Nunley.
And I'm your co-host, Steve Sellers. On ORP, we like to talk about geek stuff, pop culture, including movies and TV series, as well as comic books and comic characters. But that's not all, is it, Mike?
No, it's not, Steve. We're also writers for Omen Comics and Revelation Comics. So we like to talk about both writing and our comics. So podcast and chill with us. Today we're going to be talking about the 80s classic The Karate Kid from Columbia Pictures and its sequels. We're talking about The Karate Kid today because the film came out 39 years ago on June 22nd, 1984. And if that just made you feel old, you're not alone there. Just saying that made me grow three gray hairs. Now, if you've seen the Karate Kid movie as a comic book reader, you're probably thinking, hold on. DC Comics has a Legion of Superheroes character called the Karate Kid that's been around since 1966, a whole 16 years before the movie came out, and he is not an Italian kid from Jersey. And you'd be 100% right about that. But just to clear things up, the filmmakers received a special permission from DC Comics in 1984 to use the title for the first film and its subsequent sequels.
Oh, that's great. This character does get a lot of confusion in the world of comics. Val Armour from the Legion is a different character from Daniel LaRusso for sure, though I think he's awesome in his own way. But there's another really hilarious comic book coincidence involving the Karate Kid that I'd like to mention. There was a Marvel Comics editor in the 80s and 90s whose name was, get this, Ralph Macchio.
No way. I swear
to God, I'm not kidding about this. In fact, there were several occasions when the editor, Ralph Macchio, had to openly deny any relation to the actor because of the obvious confusion. Marvel would even sometimes use it as a bullpen joke. But to get back to the movie, it's a classic 80s series and one that comes back again and again, even to this day.
You know, I did not know about that, actually. That is both a hilarious coincidence and very awesome. I think I'd love to read some of those old bullpen jokes. Stan could be pretty snarky.
That he could.
But back to the film. The Karate Kid is credited for popularizing karate in the U.S. And as someone who was there, I can vouch for that. It's one of the reasons for the myriad of martial arts action B-movies that came out in the 80s and the karate dojos that sprung up all over the place. And we're not just talking about inspiring kids to learn karate. I can't tell you how many boys I talked to that swore they knew karate just because they had watched The Karate Kid. My guess is that's actually because writer Robert Mark Kamen actually knows a couple of different karate styles, and it shows in the film.
Oh, it does. Now, I can swear that this is true because I was one of those kids. just like Back to the Future got me into skateboarding, The Karate Kid was the film that got me into karate practice when I was about 8. I had my old karate gi, the outfit, for many years, too. I never made it past white belt, and it wasn't something I stuck with, but I had a good time doing it and got me out of the house. But Karate Kid was hugely influential on the kids of the 80s, and it came along around the time when Western pop culture became hugely interested in Japanese culture, or Okinawan in this case. This is when ninjas were all the rage in comics and anime, and manga were starting to arrive on the scene. So Karate Kid was a movie that hit the zeitgeist at the perfect time.
It did do that, and it did it in a way that many of its martial arts film predecessors did not, which made it particularly cool. The Karate Kid is a movie that is very near and dear to my heart, and actually, I was about 8 when I fell in love with it. I grew up in really rough neighborhoods, and gangs and bullies were something I had to deal with on a regular basis. I also moved around a lot and had to deal with being the new kid at school that nobody liked. What's more is that Karate Kid is ultimately what inspired me to take martial arts as a means of defending myself. Granted, I took wrestling, Shaolin Kung Fu, and Taekwondo, but I think the point is still the same.
I think it is. I think I begin to understand where Dragon Girl, now Vinyl Warrior, came from.
Guilty as charged. You nailed that one. The Buddhist principles and philosophies of the warrior Shaolin monk, and even the Shaolin monastery that I learned about when I was taking Shaolin Kung Fu, were direct influences on my character Pai Long and the Pai Long Temple where he grew up. And Danny being a poor Irish kid that lived in a bad part of town, that's definitely a bit of me in there too.
And like Karate Kid, I mean, you have a master-student relationship with a serious culture clash. But to get back to the films, you're right about the idea about Karate Kid being very relatable. I came from a military family, and I moved around every so often. So there was always getting used to new places and new people. Daniel is very much an every kid character who deals with a lot of the same issues that regular people in that situation do. It's a fish-out-of-water story with Daniel having to rebuild a new life in a new place and make peace with the world he finds himself in.
As usual, my friend, well said. While the particular details of ours and anybody else's situation might differ from Daniel's, all of us have been in situations like Daniel's, and therefore we can connect with it personally. My guess is that is why The Karate Kid did so well in the theaters and why it's still popular today, which we'll get into later. But let's talk about what made Karate Kid great beyond Robert Kamen's brilliant and relatable story. John G. Avildsen deserves a credit for filming The Karate Kid in 46 days with a very low budget of $8 million. Considering the average budget for a film in the 80s was $18 million, that wasn't much to work with. But he clearly did it, and did it well, with the help of composer Bill Conti, who both Ralph Macchio and Bill Zabka have said was a big part of selling the scenes, especially the big final crane technique kick. But speaking of those two, let's talk about the cast, who surely had a big part in why The Karate Kid was so good as well. Ralph Macchio, who we've mentioned already, is the film's protagonist, Daniel LaRusso. Pat Morita played his karate sensei, Mr. Miyagi. Elizabeth Shue came on as Daniel's love interest, Allie Mills. Billy Zabka was selected to play The Karate Kid's antagonist, Johnny Lawrence. And of course, Martin Coe was cast as John Kreese, the villain we love to hate.
Oh, and how hateable he was. The casting was pitch perfect in all of these roles. I mean, to the point where I can't imagine anyone else as any of them, especially Daniel and Miyagi, but also Johnny and Kreese. The good guys are also likable, and the villains are really easy to dislike. And so much of that is in the performances and the way these characters are written.
They really were. I think that The Karate Kid, like a lot of great classics, had all the right people in front of the camera and behind it at the right time. And that film magic that we're all looking for just happens. But before we get too much further into the discussion, I think we should do a general synopsis of the story. And that would go like this. Daniel LaRusso and his mother, Lucille, move from New Jersey to California. Daniel's mother has a great new job with good prospects, but Daniel quickly discovers that he doesn't fit in and has a difficulty figuring out how things work here on a social level. This is compounded by Daniel trying to defend Allie, a girl he likes, from what seems to be an abusive ex. But that ex turns out to be Johnny Lawrence, the best student at the local Cobra Kai karate dojo, and Daniel gets his butt kicked good. This starts the rivalry between Daniel and Johnny over Allie, and before long, Johnny's friends, who go to the same karate school, are in on it too. With a little antagonization from Daniel at a school dance, things quickly spiral out of control, however. Johnny and his friends chase Daniel down and beat him until he can't even stand up. But despite claims from his friends that Daniel has had enough, Johnny actually intends to kill Daniel with a brutal sidekick. However, Mr. Miyagi, the elderly maintenance man from Daniel's apartment complex, jumps in, pushes Daniel out of the way, and pushes Daniel out of the way of Johnny's kick and fights off Johnny and his friends. Miyagi and Daniel soon find out the real source of Johnny and his friends' violent attitude, and that is from their karate teacher, John Kreese, when they go to the Cobra Kai karate dojo to talk to him about his students bullying Daniel. Kreese and Miyagi agree to have their students fight it out in a local All-Valley Karate Championship in a few months. Miyagi teaches his family's karate from Okinawa in a very unorthodox fashion, while instructing him in the true meaning of karate, that it is for balance inside and out, and most importantly, for defense only. Ultimately, Daniel wins the tournament, and more importantly, the respect of his enemies.
That sums the story up pretty well. One of the things I like about this story is it's not just about learning karate to beat people up. The movie makes a very clear distinction between learning the art of self-defense and learning martial arts to become a bully like Johnny or Kreese. There are clear philosophical distinctions between Miyagi, who values life and mercy, and Cobra Kai, who believes that mercy is for the weak. Daniel struggles between the two sides of the coin, but ultimately chooses Miyagi's path, even if he's tempted by his rage against Johnny for what he does to him. The adopted father-son relationship between Miyagi and Daniel, I think, saves Daniel from taking that darker path. I think both Miyagi's philosophy and Yoda's from Empire Strikes Back had the most impact on me growing up of all the films I watched as a child.
Wow. That's saying quite a bit. There are some diametrically opposing views on karate, what some would call the wrong way and the right way. And The Karate Kid does a great job of showing both sides, in my opinion. I think it's safe to say that you love The Karate Kid like I do, Steve. I would also say that, like it did with me, the film left a lasting impression on you. And I think that the writer Robert Kamen would love that it did. Quick thing, though. Did you know that the core story from The Karate Kid that so many others found relatable as well came from a writer who also went through similar things growing up?
I actually did not, but that explains a lot. I think the lived experience often shows in any work of fiction. I call the truth at the heart of the lie, if that makes sense. And it definitely feels like Kamen lived a lot of the things that are in these films. Mike, I guess you know how all that came about?
I do, but first, I must agree about the lived experience resonating in a story. As a reader, or in this case, as a viewer, you don't even have to have lived through what you're seeing or reading yourself to feel the authenticity of actual life in the story. But back to Kamen. The edition of the Karate Kid trilogy that I have has a bunch of featurettes and docs in it for the first film that I learned a fair amount from, and that's where I'm getting a lot of my information from. So let's talk a little bit about Karate Kid creator, writer Robert Kamen's creation process and get into a bit of that philosophical stuff you were talking about. Kamen was approached by Columbia Pictures to write a film starring John G. Avildsen's similar to John G. Avildsen's previous successful film, Rocky, from 1976, who they had signed on to direct whatever Kamen came up with. As it happens, Robert Kamen actually had a story that was inspired by his own life that he'd been sitting on for years that fit the bill. Turns out that Kamen, too, was an East Coast kid, New York specifically, coming to California's West Coast for the first time. Also, he took karate to defend himself from bullies when, at age 17, after the 1964 New York World's Fair, Kamen was beaten up by a gang of bullies. But his initial instructor taught a very serious and deadly form of karate that encouraged the same kind of vicious ideals and philosophies about life that you see in the Cobra Kai from the film. That the karate was a violent tool just for revenge. So Kamen switched disciplines to Okinawan Goju Ryu karate under a Japanese teacher who had been a student of Koji Miyagi. Now, if you don't know who Koji Miyagi is, he lived from April 25th, 1988 to October 8th, 1953, and he was the Okinawan martial artist who founded Goju Ryu School of Karate, which blended Okinawan and Chinese influences. As a result of this close personal connection to the story, Kamen maintained strong opinions about the cast and who was going to be there.
Understandable. Wow, that's really interesting. I never knew that so much of Karate Kid was based on real people and dojos. But I think that's also why this movie has so much authenticity and feels like a story that could really have taken place. Daniel as a character feels very real, as does Miyagi. And what I know of from my time in karate practice lines up pretty well with what's shown in the film, at least the first one. It sounds like Kamen was instrumental in keeping the film grounded in lived experience and the rich tradition of Japanese karate.
He definitely did that. I feel as though I should clarify one quick point, though. And that is, while Karate Kid is based, and Miyagi-Do Karate is based on real disciplines, technically, Miyagi-Do Karate is a blend of styles, like its root in Okinawan Karate, which, as I mentioned before, is a blend of Japanese styles. It is not actually a literal style. Apparently, that is a frequently asked question, and I don't want to be misleading. But Robert Kamen was not the only person working on the film with a martial arts background. The film's fight choreographer, Pat E. Johnson, who also appears as the referee in the movie, is a Tang Soo-do karate black belt who had worked on Bruce Lee's 1973 classic Enter the Dragon. He worked with Brandon Lee, Jackie Chan, and Chuck Norris at American Tang Soo-do martial arts schools. Even Pat Morita's stunt double, Fumio Demura, is a karate black belt who had previously worked with Bruce Lee.
That is some impressive background right there. I mean, even though Bruce Lee was best known for Jeet Kune Do, he studied many different forms of martial arts and taught quite a few people during his lifetime. Chuck Norris was himself a disciple of Bruce Lee's at one point. So when you tell me that Johnson and Fumio have history working with Bruce Lee and his disciples, that is no small achievement. I definitely think that is why the karate in this film feels less like movie martial arts and more like how real karate might have been practiced.
It definitely has that feel. I would add that it feels like a unique teaching experience with how Kamen came up with Miyagi's karate lessons. You know, secretly teaching Daniel that karate moves, that he wanted to learn, while increasing his pain tolerance and building the muscle memory that he would need for the karate to even be effective. Kamen talked about how he wanted the fact that Daniel had been learning the whole time to be a surprise to Daniel, and I think he pulled it off well. It feels very authentic to me that old men would put their students to work, and that's how Miyagi-Do has always been taught.
Yeah, that's one of the more awesome things about the first film. It's the relation of life to martial arts and the relation of martial arts to life and how the two feed into each other. The two are inseparable, as Kamen shows us, and when one about is out of balance, so is the other. There's a definitely Eastern way of thinking to what seems like a simple training regimen.
Inseparable is right. Like space and time or electricity and magnetism, you'll notice that Miyagi often refers to nature to explain why, to paraphrase him, nature makes the rules, Daniel, not me. I believe this gives a sense of purity to the philosophical and physical teachings that nature itself declares these things to be true.
Yeah, it's acceptance of nature, of the universe, and one's place in it, and not striving to be more than you are. This is probably why arrogance is regarded as one of the worst sins of these films. But there was another piece of the puzzle there too, right?
That's true. And as Metallica put it, arrogance and ignorance go in hand. Pride is blinding, and more often than not, it only leads to a downfall, as the Karate Kid franchise definitely hammers in. But about there being more pieces to the puzzle of the Karate Kid story, not all of the Karate Kid story was derived from Kamen's life. Robert Kamen's mentor, Frank Price, told him that told him that Karate Kid producer Jerry Weintraub had optioned a news article about the young child of a single mother who had earned a black belt to defend himself against neighborhood bullies. Using that story as a framework for the script, Kamen added elements from his own life and created the screenplay for The Karate Kid. Apparently, because director John G. Avildsen worked on both films, Sylvester Stallone often joked with Kamen that he had ripped off the Karate Kid films with the Rocky films with the Karate Kid. In truth, I don't see it as a ripoff at all. There's very little about the film that could even be compared with Rocky, in my opinion. If anybody was attempting to do that, it was Columbia Pictures, as that's why they hired Kamen. But, I mean, I think Kamen came up with something entirely new.
Yeah, I don't think it was a ripoff either. That's a very odd comparison to me, I have to say. Rocky Balboa is someone who turns fighting into his career, and it becomes a huge part of his life and who he is as a person. I mean, he gets knocked down and he gets back up and he fights because it's all he really knows. I don't think that's Daniel. Daniel gets into karate because he's forced into a position where he needs to learn to defend himself. And then as he does, he has to decide what kind of man he wants to be, a bully or someone who defends the weak. Those are very different stories in my view.
I was a bit surprised to read that myself. I've never considered the films or the characters to be even remotely alike. Two totally different stories going on there. Honestly, it feels like something that would get started on Twitter by people who have never seen either film.
I know, right? It's a bit Hollywood thinking, too. I mean, it's a film about a regular guy who fights. It's the same as Rocky. No, it's really not. But why don't we get into how Ralph Macchio is not Stallone?
That sounds like a good idea. Robert Kamen said that Daniel needed to be a wimp, which is, of course, exactly like Rocky. But seriously, came in wanted a wimp with a chip on his shoulder, and there were actually several actors that were considered for the role besides Macchio, including Sean Penn, Robert Downey Jr., Charlie Sheen, John Cryer, Emilio Estevez, Nicolas Cage, Anthony Edwards, C. Thomas Howell, Tom Cruise, Eric Stoltz, and even D.B. Sweeney. However, they went with Macchio based on his performance as Johnny Cade in the 1983 film The Outsiders, which was actually Macchio's first major film role. What's more is that the Johnny Cade character influenced how Macchio played Daniel. However, Robert Kamen did not originally like Ralph Macchio at all and said that he was sweet but obnoxious when he met him. Macchio had showed up with quite an attitude because he thought the project sounded stupid. Specifically, he thought that the Karate Kid sounded like a Saturday morning cartoon. However, he did relate on some level to Daniel as he was not one of the biggest kids in his adolescence, and he knew what that felt like. He wasn't picked on as much as Daniel, but as Macchio put it, he was also not as defiant as Daniel later was. Macchio later commented that the character was actually originally named Daniel Weber, Danny Weber. A very un-Italian name. As soon as he walked in, though, it was changed to LaRusso.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned The Outsiders, because that was a book I had to read a couple of times in high school, and I vaguely remember the film. I can see the similarity between Macchio's performance there and in Karate Kid, but it's true that Ralph Macchio really made the Daniel character who he is, and changing the name was a good move. I just don't feel like Danny Weber has the same ring to it, and adding the Italian background from Jersey really deepens the character. I also have to say that it's impressive that Macchio was able to beat out a truly impressive list of names, many of whom were the hottest thing going in the mid-80s. But I think Macchio's natural personality was such a good fit for Daniel that he's shown in that role.
I really like the Italian background as well. I'm not an expert on Italian culture, but in my experience, family is really important there. And really just having that background automatically just builds that relationship with his mom in there. You automatically understand how that's going to work out. Mm-hmm. But Macchio really brought what Kamen was looking for. Just enough sweetness that you had to love him, but still with a little bit of attitude. Speaking of lovable characters, however, let's talk about the casting of Mr. Miyagi. The studio originally wanted the role of Mr. Miyagi to be played by Toshiro Mifune, who had appeared in Akira Kurosawa's films Rashomon, Seven Samurai, and A Hidden Fortress. However, Mifune's Miyagi was a scary Miyagi. He was full of dignity and Bushido and very serious. This Miyagi would have been a respectable sensei by all means, but not quite the lovable old man that they were looking for. Pat Morita, who is a stand-up comic known for playing Arnold on Happy Days, later auditioned for the role, but the studio initially felt like he might be too much of a comedic actor for the role of Mr. Miyagi. However, Pat just blew them away with his performance. While Morita grew a beard and patterned his accent after his uncle, as he had no accent of his own, to this day, he's not sure where Mr. Miyagi character came from. It just kind of came out of him. But that performance, which nailed a little bit of the sadness you see in the eyes of those who have fought in war, mixed with that wise and lovable sage, led to him being cast in the role. Ralph Macchio commented that while the lovable comedic aspect of Mr. Miyagi was on the page to some extent, Pat Morita really just brought it to the next level. Billy Zabka said that Morita could keep the tone of the movie really well, too, with his performance. Even in the more serious scenes, in the darker moments, it doesn't go too dark because of Pat Morita. And also, even in the lighter scenes, it doesn't go too far into the comedy either. One thing that helped a lot was Ralph Macchio and Pat Morita had a great chemistry. They worked really well together, and they worked on scenes a lot. And through the process, they became good friends, and that added a lot to it, too. But that magic you see on the screen between the two characters is in large part because Morita's performance inspired and fed into Macchio's portrayal of Daniel. It just came out of him working with Morita.
That makes sense. Toshiro Mifune was probably everyone's first choice for wise old Japanese master around that point in time. Keep in mind that Mifune was also the first choice to play Obi-Wan Kenobi in Star Wars A New Hope until the roles went to Sir Alec Guinness. And it's not hard to see why. Mifune had that presence, and he embodied the samurai hero so well. You see that in all those Kurosawa films, from Seven Samurai to Yojimbo. But at the same time, I think Pat Morita was the right choice here. Toshiro Mifune had gravitas and dignity, and I think he would have brought that to Miyagi. But what Morita offers is a kindness and a certain level of impish humor, both of which I think are central to who Miyagi is in the film. Morita's an actor with a decent amount of range, and outside of this, I mainly remember him as a Japanese officer in Midway and things like that. But in this role, we see that Morita brings a lot of heart, and I think that sets him apart from what Mifune might have done.
There is definitely a huge difference in how that could have gone and how it ended up. And hopefully I can explain what I mean in a way that makes sense. But I think that Mifune's Mr. Miyagi would have commanded respect and honor with who he was. But Pat Morita brought the perfect blend of lovable and respectable. Morita's Mr. Miyagi, he knew he was the deadliest man on the planet, but he wore it with a humility that made you want to respect and honor him, and not because of his powerful presence, but because of his gentle and humble one.
Exactly. Also, Pat Morita doesn't look like a martial arts master, which I think is part of his charm. He looks like a gentle old guy who wouldn't hurt anyone, and mostly he's not, until he has to defend himself or someone else, and that's when he kicks your ass. But yeah. While Miyagi is a standout character, he's not the only one, is he?
Actually, no, he isn't, Steve. When it came to the antagonist of the story, Johnny Lawrence, the studio initially considered Crispin Glover for the role. If you recognize that name, Crispin Glover is best known for playing the awkward nerd George McFly in the 1985 classic Back to the Future. Glover is just not a tough guy, and there is absolutely nothing scary about Crispin Glover. Whereas Ralph Macchio commented that Zabka scared the living shit out of him. So, I mean, I think you can see why Glover was not a good fit for Johnny Lawrence, and the studio went for Billy Zabka instead.
Absolutely right. What you need is somebody like Biff, not like George McFly. At the same time, I do feel like Johnny isn't a stereotypical bully either, and I think Zabka understood that. Johnny is what Daniel becomes if he takes the wrong path. He's abused by his master, and he takes that rage and turns it on those weaker than himself. I think we see both the pain and the unchecked anger in Zabka, where we wouldn't have in a Crispin Glover.
Definitely, definitely. I could not have said that better. The debut role was a natural fit for Zabka, who actually felt as if he really understood the character, because he basically was Johnny Lawrence. Zabka even viewed Daniel LaRusso as the villain in the movie and said that Johnny had every right to do what he did to Daniel for stealing his girlfriend. That was a note that would be picked up decades later with the Cobra Kai series. But back to the film. In Billy Zabka's words, something just came over him at the audition for The Karate Kid that never happened to him before. And Zabka did something the actors just do not do, and that was walk up and grab the director. And he didn't just grab him. Zabka got right in John Avildsen's face and said, "Watch your mouth, asshole," and pushed Avildsen into his chair. Zabka then exited the room thinking that, well, even if he didn't get the part, at least he got to throw the director in the chair. But he quickly came back in and said, "You know what? I'm sorry. That wasn't Billy. That was Johnny." Avildsen then asked, "How old are you? You're a little bit bigger than our Karate Kid." Zabka responded, "Well, Bruce Lee was smaller than Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, but he beat him," in reference to the Game of Death, to which Avildsen responded, "Yeah, that's true," and cast Billy Zabka for the role. When he was cast, Zabka was a wrestler and had no previous training in karate, but fight choreographer Pat Johnson trained him and the rest of the crew.
Wow, some actors take method acting a bit too far. Jared Leto, anyone? But I think Zabka found the right approach to Johnny as a character beyond that. From his perspective, he's fighting for what he sees as his. And honestly, I feel a bit sorry for Johnny in a sense, even though I don't condone any of his actions. Johnny's the way he is because Kreese set a terrible example, and we see that Kreese is physically abusive towards Johnny. After the tournament, Kreese calls Johnny a loser and chokes him within an inch of his life for taking second place, something that many sensei would take pride in. I think Johnny was lost in the same way Daniel once was, and his worst tendencies were brought out by a master that he initially idolized, but could never satisfy with less than perfection, and who treated him horribly. I think Johnny's a case of misdirected rage, where he becomes what he hates, and he takes out his anger on everyone except the true source of his pain, which is Kreese. And in the end, he'll never be happy that way, because that only drives away anybody who can help him straighten out his life, as we see in Cobra Kai. Johnny's relationship with Kreese is a dark mirror of Daniel and Miyagi, except twisted and abusive. Zabka, I think, captures that well, trying to see Johnny as the hero of his own story.
You're exactly right about that. Even Miyagi said in the movie that there's no such thing as a bad student, only a bad teacher. And the dichotomy between Kreese and Miyagi certainly exemplifies that. As I mentioned before, the theme of The Karate Kid is that there's a right and a wrong way to do karate, something the franchise digs into further in the Cobra Kai series, which we'll get into in a bit.
Absolutely. I think Johnny is a character who only gets better over time, but I'm glad he gets his due in Cobra Kai.
Yeah, he does eventually. And I think really all these elements we've been talking about blend together to make the Karate that really made the Karate Kid a commercial success, both in the U.S. and in Canada. It grossed over $100 million. Considering they made it on a budget of $8 million, that's pretty damn good. In fact, The Karate Kid was one of the highest grossing films of 1984, and nobody saw it coming. But in 1984, Roger Ebert said that The Karate Kid was one of the year's best films and gave it 4 out of 4 stars. Ebert described it as an exciting, sweet-tempered, heartwarming story with one of the most interesting friendships in a long time. It won an Academy Award for Best Actor in a Supporting Role and was nominated for a Golden Globe for Best Performance by an Actor in a Supporting Role in a Motion Picture, both of those for Pat Morita.
Who am I to argue with Robert Ebert? All of that is well-deserved. I mean, imagine a movie like that getting an Oscar today. But it was a movie that came in at the right time and it tapped into universal human themes. It's one of those movies that I think will always stick around in one way or another.
It is one of those truly timeless films, and one I think we could go on another 20 minutes about at least. But after that somewhat lengthy discussion on the first film, let's get into the first sequel. The Karate Kid Part 2 is one of the perfect examples for how to make a great sequel, I mean, at least as far as I'm concerned. It's just brilliantly written, in my opinion. Structure, pace, character building, story progression. The Karate Kid really expounded on Mr. Miyagi and Daniel's close relationship and showed just how deep it runs. It raised the stakes and brought the story back to its roots by further exploring Okinawan culture and karate. A perfect example of this further exploration was actually a fairly quick scene, but I love the two rules of karate that were hanging on the dojo at Miyagi's father's house. Rule number one, karate is for defense only. Rule number two, first learn rule number one. Now, I'm not saying it's as good a sequel. It's not as good a film as The Wrath of Khan. But both films, in my opinion, should be studied for how sequels are supposed to be done. But again, that's just me. Do you have any thoughts on that one, Steve?
No, I'm in complete agreement with you on part two. I remember really liking this movie when I saw it as a kid, and I felt like it did a good job of building on what the first one did. Looking back at it now, I think this film has grown over time, if anything. It makes sense to focus on Miyagi's past, and taking Daniel to Okinawa puts him back in the fish out of water situation that worked for the first film. It goes back to the idea of doing what the first film did, but different. And some bits of it hold up on repeat viewing and make it even better. For instance, if you look at Miyagi's fight with Kreese early on, you see that he's using the drum technique that he teaches Daniel later in the film and that Daniel uses on Chosen at the end.
Wow. You just totally made me feel like a dumbass there. I've watched that movie a whole bunch of times, and I never picked up on the early drum technique there. But that was a nice pickup, my friend. That scene, or rather, what Mr. Miyagi said, also lends heavily into where we find Kreese in Cobra Kai 2. Miyagi said that he didn't kill Kreese because a man that has no forgiveness in his heart lives in worse punishment than death. But again, we'll get into that in a few minutes.
And Miyagi was right about that, too. But for now, let's talk about the basic plot of Part 2. The film picks up right after the karate tournament at the end of Part 1. This is where we see Kreese threatening Johnny for being a loser, and Miyagi humiliates him in a one-on-one fight with the drum technique. Later on, we find that Daniel's mother is going to Fresno, and she leaves Daniel with Miyagi for the summer. Miyagi gets a letter from his old girlfriend in Okinawa, Yukie, who tells Miyagi that his father is dying. Miyagi goes to honor his father, but it opens up old wounds. His former best friend, turned enemy, Sato, wants to challenge him to a fight over honor. Before leaving Okinawa, Miyagi had announced to the village that he was going to marry Yukie when she was promised to Sato in marriage. Miyagi says goodbye to his father, who was also Sato's old master. But after 3 days, Sato promises he'll come to finish what he started. And in the meantime, Daniel gets into his own troubles. He gets involved with Yukie's niece, Kumiko, and he makes an enemy of Sato's nephew, Chozen. The story revolves around Miyagi trying to stick to his principles of nonviolence, not wanting to kill his best friend, while Daniel's trying to learn about a culture he doesn't really know or understand.
That's a pretty good summary, and I think it covers the general story of Part 2 pretty good. You know, one aspect of the second film that I really liked was seeing beneath Miyagi's armor. What I mean is that Miyagi really just had the one moment of weakness, or rather a crack in the armor in the first film. Of course, I'm referring to when he gets drunk and recalls the news of when his wife and child had died due to complications during birth when he was stationed during World War II. Miyagi seemed to have all the answers and have everything together through most of the first film. And that one moment showed that he was human, that he carried pain and regret in his heart like the rest of us. In fact, that was the scene that won Pat Morita an award. But in Part 2, we get to see Mr. Miyagi's mistakes laid bare. And while there is still a clear teacher-student relationship as Daniel is learning through the whole movie, it seems clear by the second film that the surrogate father and adopted son relationship between Daniel and Miyagi that took root in the first film is in full force by the second one. Because of that, things changed a bit as far as their roles in the story. In The Karate Kid Part 2, Daniel is one of those who is the one who is there for Miyagi and actually gets tangled up in problems created because of Miyagi's youthful pride. Whereas it was the other way around before, like they switched places in some ways. I think that's why we see Daniel learning from what happened with Miyagi's prideful announcement to the whole village about how he and Yukie were going to get married, despite their families already having an arranged marriage between her and Sato. I'm sure that having chosen Taguchi, Sato's nephew, threatened to kill him if he was dishonored again certainly amped up the seriousness of honor in Okinawa in Daniel's eyes. I can't help but notice, though, that when Daniel is with Kumiko at the dance club and things look like they might be getting a little serious, Daniel immediately asks Kumiko if she's arranged to be married. As Mr. Miyagi pointed out before they ever left Okinawa, honor is everything there. And they do a great job of showing that and using it to really build the intensity of that final fight to the death with Chozen.
Yeah, agreed. I think you hit on it when you talked about Miyagi's announcement being prideful, because pride is a recurring theme in this film. And the story treats pride as the architect of the character's mixed fortunes. Miyagi fails in his youth by his prideful announcement, which in turn wounds Sato's pride. As much as honor is treated as an important concept in Okinawan culture, the villains are motivated by pride more than they are by honor. Sato can't put aside his pride enough, even to honor his dying master's wish that he and Miyagi put aside their differences. Chozen is even more prideful as he takes his thugs to pick a fight with Daniel because Daniel exposed his cheating in the village. These are people who confuse wounded pride for dishonor, dishonoring themselves in the name of pride. Miyagi, however, swallows his pride and walks away from a fight that he could probably win because he doesn't want to kill a friend in a pointless duel. The film makes the case that real honor is turning away from pride to do the right thing, no matter what that costs. This is the lesson that Daniel ends up learning as well, following Miyagi's example in his fight with Chozen at the end. It's a profound lesson that this movie teaches, and it does that really well with all of these characters.
You know, that's interesting. Now that I'm thinking about it, pride really is at the center of it all, like we talked about briefly earlier. I mean, you can find that root of pride in the first film, too, in Daniel, who just couldn't leave well enough alone, in Johnny, who couldn't accept that Allie had ended things with him, in John Kreese, by taking it as a personal affront that Johnny won second place, and even in Mike Barnes in Part 3, which we're about to get into.
Very, very true. Pride is the larger theme of the entire series, as you effectively pointed out here. And as Miyagi says in Part 3, quote, karate is to be used for defense or for honor. It is not to be used for a shiny plastic trophy, unquote. Miyagi's lessons are all about true honor over pride. And he lives by that example, too. I mean, the dude won the Congressional Medal of Honor, and he takes no pride in it. As he says to Daniel, this don't say you brave, this say you lucky. For Miyagi, it is never about reward or status or pride. He never even fights for himself most of the time. He always fights for the life and the honor of others. And this is the lesson that Daniel again, hits Daniel again in part three. So why don't we get into that film?
Absolutely. Despite being written by Robert Kamen and even directed by John Avildsen, Karate Kid had, I don't know, it had the same spirit, but it had a different feel than the first two films did. I'm not saying that to impugn the film, just that, I don't know, it's different.
Yeah, I think I would say the same about this. I'll be honest, this is where I started to tune out of the series for a long time. I mean, not because I dislike the movie or anything, but because I found the shift in tone really jarring. I remember this movie getting pretty dark in contrast with the first two films.
You know, jarring is a good way of putting it. But at the same time, while it rehashes a bit of old topics, I can see where Kamen was going with Daniel's character. Daniel's root had to grow into its own tree. I really like the bonsai metaphor for Daniel's karate, how the root is from Miyagi. But like the bonsai chooses its own way to grow, so too would Daniel. And that perfectly sums up the essence of the movie. In part three, the root teacher-student relationship that Daniel and Miyagi had grew into a father-son relationship and finally morphed into a man-to-man relationship now that Daniel is older. Also, as a man, Daniel has to learn that his teacher and father and best friend, Mr. Miyagi's teachings were right by coming to that conclusion on his own. Unfortunately, that means Daniel has to lose his way and his balance before the seed of wisdom planted in his mind by Mr. Miyagi truly takes root in Daniel's own heart. That's just a great story and so true to how we learn. We can have all of the facts. We can have all of the knowledge in our mind about something. But for it to grow into something useful, to truly become wisdom, it has to become a part of us.
Yeah, that's true. I think that Miyagi becomes so disappointed in Daniel's disinterest in his college education because he sees potential that Daniel doesn't want to realize. Miyagi, by this point, probably realized that Daniel's perhaps too invested in Miyagi that he's doing a disservice to himself in his own life. He's turning to Miyagi a little too often for wisdom and not taking enough responsibility for himself and his own decisions. The story of part three is about Daniel learning to fly on his own, how to find his own path, and I think it sets him to become the person he becomes at the start of Cobra Kai. So the bonsai analogy becomes a metaphor for Daniel's own life and direction as a person as a future karate master.
It really does spell out the plot of Karate Kid perfectly, of Karate Kid Part 3 perfectly, doesn't it? I really like that Kamen brought in the more traditional forms of martial arts into the third film. And by forms, I mean the kata exercises Miyagi taught Daniel. Miyagi says that like all bonsai are found in trees, all karate is found in his family's kata. These basic movements are the building blocks of all karate forms, like forms are the building blocks of kung fu. The particular type of kata used is based on Seiunshin, an original Goju Ryu kata originally created by Higayana Kanryu, sorry, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that correctly, and it was passed down to Kojun Miyagi. Anyway, it's important because it's, in my experience, if you want to fight free form, you have to first learn the forms to be effective. The first two films were a bit free form for me, and I felt like this gave it more grounding. There's something else about doing forms in kata that the film shows, and it brings it to the forefront, and I think it's a great aspect to show about martial arts, and that thing is peace. Doing forms or kata is relaxing and centering. It brings focus and clarity. I don't know the biological reasons for it, but I have been really pissed or bent out of shape, or like Daniel was in the movie, succumbing to fear, and it brought me back. There's something that happens with the movements and the breathing that is corrective on a spiritual level, like a realignment. That calm has purpose, too, beyond serenity, as we get to see in the tournament. It's okay to lose to an opponent or situation, but it's not okay to lose to fear.
Yeah, I like that each film seems to really dig into a different layer of Eastern philosophy towards the martial arts and how they connect to a different way of living. In the first film, it was the crane technique that Daniel uses to defeat Johnny in the tournament. In the second film, it's the drum technique and the way of pure defense by way of avoiding hits. With part three, the final lesson is the way of the bonsai and the kata, which gets to the core of karate as a discipline. You can see the Karate Kid trilogy is almost a three-act meditation on the martial arts and how they are a practical way to live a better life.
Hot damn. You need to teach a class or something on how to say stuff in just the right way. The trilogy can totally be seen in that way, and I feel like you, like Miyagi, brought a new light to something I thought I already knew about. I feel the sturdiness of the three-legged stool analogy coming on.
Well, indeed, but let's take this a step further, right? I would like to touch briefly on the character of Terry Silver, because he is such an over-the-top 80s villain, even compared to Kreese and Sato. This guy is manipulative and sadistic, and I'd even go so far as to say that he's probably a total psychopath. Silver has absolutely nothing against Daniel and Miyagi personally whatsoever, but he agrees to destroy their lives without a second thought. Even Kreese shows more hesitation than Silver does about Silver's campaign of total personal destruction. And all because Silver feels a bond of loyalty to Kreese, because Kreese saved his life in Vietnam more than once. I get the feeling Silver was one of those guys who went off to war and got off on blood and death, much like we talked about with the Punisher. But Punisher at least channels that love of killing to slaughtering criminals. I don't think Silver cares who he destroys as long as he gets the thrill he's after, and that makes him a truly terrifying villain. I'm glad he came back for Cobra Kai, because I think he's one of the more interesting villains in the series.
You know, I can certainly see why you would get that impression. I mean, they also show him being willing to dump toxic waste in populated areas just to make a buck. And he's also someone who acquires businesses, which requires a bit of sharking. But in the Cobra Kai series, we see a major change in that Silver was all but a coward and basically had no business being in a war. He is not the same vicious predator from Karate Kid 3. This seems like a character rewrite by the new writers based on the differences between Karate Kid 3 and Cobra Kai Season 4. Unfortunately, Kamen was not the writer for the new series, but why don't we get into Cobra Kai before we run out of time?
Yeah, it does seem that way. I don't have a problem with that change, though, necessarily. I think the total monster for part three might be a little too intense for what they're going for on that show. And Terry from part three is a really over-the-top bad guy, and they may have wanted him to be a little less exaggerated. But yes, let's look into Cobra Kai a bit more.
Right. A live-action sequel series debuted in 2018 on YouTube Red that was created by Joss Heald, John Hurwitz, and Hayden Schlossberg. A second season followed in 2019, but this time on YouTube Premium. A third season was actually made by YouTube, but they decided to quit doing scripted programming, which left the very unpopular show without a home. Netflix picked up the show in 2020 and released the already made season 3 in 2021, and the fourth season dropped at the end of the same year. But before the fourth season could even launch, Netflix renewed it again for a fifth season.
I can understand why. I'll admit that I came into Cobra Kai late. Though I kept hearing it was a good show, I was just done with Karate Kid for a good long time, and I tend to be very hesitant about revisiting series that I loved in my childhood once I've turned out of them. But after finally watching some of it, I admit that was a mistake. I feel like if you're going to continue a classic series, Cobra Kai is the right way to do it.
You know, I was a little hesitant myself, I gotta admit. But curiosity won over my doubts, and I jumped on that in that first year on YouTube Red. Now, it was different, but I said to myself, so was Karate Kid 3, and I liked that. And like you, I actually thought it was pretty good. The new series starred Ralph Macchio and as Daniel LaRusso and Billy Zabka as Johnny Lawrence once again, but this time it's 34 years later. Also, the Miyagi-verse narrative, which draws on all of the films, even the next Karate Kid, which I'm not going to talk about, was re-examined from Johnny's point of view, that he was actually the hero of the story. Johnny's life is just crap and spiraling out of control when he decides to return to his karate roots and reopen the Cobra Kai dojo, which in turn reignites sparks into flames with his old rival Daniel.
I'm still behind on Cobra Kai, though I'm familiar with the broad strokes of the show. I think Johnny is the perfect character to focus on for this show, though. Daniel already got a pretty good arc in the three films he got, and Johnny is a sympathetic antagonist with a lot of room to grow. I think we definitely see an interesting character story for Johnny in Cobra Kai. He's a washout who never got past his glory days, still harbors resentment because his life never worked out the way he wanted it. His family is broken, he can't maintain a job because of his aggression problems, and the only thing he's really good at is fighting.
No, I didn't call her a bitch. I said she was bitching at me. There's a difference. Yeah, Johnny definitely has seen better days than where we find him in Cobra Kai, and honestly, it fits. I mean, many kids who were super popular in high school basically peaked early on in life, and, well, what's left is not a lot of fun.
Yeah, true enough, but I think the decision to become a sensei was the right one for him. Karate is what Johnny knows and loves, and he's someone with a great deal to prove to himself. By passing on what he knows, Johnny learns to care about someone outside of himself, and that's something that will either save him or destroy him. I honestly want to see Johnny find some kind of peace and make something out of his life, because I don't believe that he's deep down that bad of a person. He eventually rejects the more extreme ways of Kreese, and he finds his own path, which is, oddly enough, the lesson Miyagi was trying to instill into Daniel in Part 3.
Yeah, you nailed that one. That's true. You know, I'm actually all caught up on the Cobra Kai series, and I'm eagerly awaiting season 5. So I can tell you that Johnny does eventually get to a better place, and he does find his peace by teaching and being a surrogate father to Miguel, even if it's a long road to get there. And it's interesting that you compare Johnny's journey from the first film to Cobra Kai to the becoming one's own man story we saw with Daniel in Karate Kid Part 3, because that's how I would describe it as well. Although Daniel does it in a single movie, and Johnny is still working it all out in season 4. I feel like reaching that point of being your own man or woman is what's really important, not necessarily how long it took to get there.
Well, that sounds really awesome, and it makes me want to get further into the series. I like the Johnny Miguel relationship a lot and the way it evolves over time. I mean, Johnny starts off barely tolerating this poor kid, and then he becomes his master. Then Miguel becomes his favorite pupil and something like the son he lost. The surrogate family themes are a huge part of what Karate Kid is, and it looks like Cobra Kai has done well at taking it to the next generation of fighters.
You know, family and what defines it is definitely an ongoing theme that is all over Cobra Kai. One thing is made very obvious. Family is not created by blood alone. Family can be friends. It can be students of the same master and even a master and their students. Family is how our lives and hearts define it. But ultimately, aside from what we've touched on already, the reason The Karate Kid and its sequels hold such a classic status and have survived the test of time is their spiritual and philosophical message. Martial arts films in the eyes of the U.S. before The Karate Kid were all violence and action for the most part, without any real substance or culture to them beyond the superficial. And I'm not pointing fingers here, but before Karate Kid, I thought knowing martial arts made you a badass, and then that was the end of it. I didn't even know that there was anything to learn about martial arts other than violence. But the Karate Kid films, mostly due to Mr. Miyagi, showed me and a lot of other people that martial arts is about 70% spiritual and 30% martial. I mean spiritual. Mr. Miyagi taught us, as he taught Daniel, that at its core, martial arts is really an existential philosophy about balance in all things. The violence in martial arts in its purest form is not about being a badass or winning competitions. It's knowing that if it came down to it, if there was no other option, you are capable of defending yourself and your loved ones. As Daniel put it in the movie with Mr. Miyagi's direction, we learn karate so that we don't have to fight.
Yep. Miyagi says it himself on this one. If you fight smarter, not harder, you can avoid fighting. He also talks about the soul as the root of the tree, with proper training as the best way to grow in life. Miyagi's one of the great mentor characters, and his philosophy is one that is so applicable outside of the films. The martial arts are a weapon, but it matters who wields that weapon and for what purpose. There are things that great thinkers have contemplated for many years, but Miyagi popularized them by stating them so clearly and in plain terms. It's a philosophical series under all the karate fights, a series about personal empowerment and growth, but it tells its lesson without preaching at the audience, and that's not an easy thing for any film to do, much less 3 films and a TV series.
You know, that's a good call. That is not something that is easy to do. And it is inspiring, to be sure. You know, some movies are so good that they help inspire who we become. And The Karate Kid is one of those movies that inspired me and you as well. What's more is how long it lasted. My parents and many others of their generation love The Karate Kid. And the kids like me and you who loved the movie back in the 80s are now watching these beloved movies with their own children who love them too. This franchise is up there as one of my favorite trilogies of all time. And I'm really excited that we got to do an episode on this. But we are out of time, however. But before we go, though, I would like to take a moment to thank our patrons who helped make this podcast possible. I hope you've had fun hanging out with us today on ORP. I know that Steve and I have had fun making this episode. If you've had fun, too, we invite you to share this episode and help us get the word out.
For our Spotify listeners, we ask you to please rate our show as well. That can really help to grow our audience. But to all our listeners everywhere, we want to say thank you for listening, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.